It's always a little scary to talk to such a diverse crowd, especially about science, because I'm not trained as a scientist, but I am interested in it as a social process. So let me tell you a little bit about how I came to this project. I published a book in 2000 called Communicating Science, and it was with a rhetorician named Alan Gross. And what we did is we showed how scientists write and communicate, and how that changes over time. And so the introduction of the abstract or passive voice, or, you know, humanists would say the rate of the growth of the crack. And scientists would nominalize that and say crack growth rate, right? And so when is that introduced, and how does it, and why, and what are the factors? And so the last chapter, we explain change over time by using kind of the best theory there is to show change over time, explain it, and that's Darwinian natural selection. So you apply natural selection, really selection theory, and show how writing changes. I thought it was super neat. It was a metaphor. We didn't have the mechanisms of natural selection, of course, very complicated. And we got a lot of pushback for that, but it was fun. And he contacted me. I hadn't seen him for 15 years, and he contacted me about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and said, hey, let's write a book on E.O. Wilson. And I got to know E.O. Wilson when he visited here. If you have ever met him, you know he's a very sort of gentle, kind, thoughtful man. And I really enjoyed his company. I'd met him through George Karametchov, another very kind, gentle soul, all of whom are interested in connecting the science and the humanities. As I'll get to in the talk, I also hated E.O. Wilson. I hated his ideas. I was trained that he was sort of the enemy, the antagonist in the story of intellectual development in the West. So I said, sure, Alan, I'll do this. And so I taught a class on E.O. Wilson as an honors seminar last semester, so just so I could catch up and read all there is to read about him. We basically just read, sort of 13 of his books. And it turned out he, like me and others, has sort of one big idea and then writes about it in 13 different ways in those books. But I also sort of had a profound respect for the diversity of his thought, his goals, whether he reached them or not, or whether he did it in the right way. I respected his scholarship. I also learned that almost everything he does is extremely controversial. So that's kind of where I've gotten into this. It's new work for me. So I'm going to have to stick kind of to notes. What I want to do is make a couple points. One is the debates around sociobiology have existed for a very, very long time, and they're the exact same debates, sort of just wrapped up in different form. And then to show and try to end by showing that we've come actually a very long, long way, and an interesting way that does link up science and humanities in very interesting ways, I thought. So, sociobiology. It's the biological basis of social behavior, is the definition of that. And it doesn't seem that controversial. I think we all understand that there's a biological basis of social behavior. E.O. Wilson published Sociobiology in 1975, and then there was some debate about it, some vigorous debate. So at a meeting of the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in 1978, so 3 years after, they decided to sort of debate sociobiology on the main main evening attraction for the AAAS meeting. And when Wilson started to get up, demonstrators stopped the whole meeting. They started chanting, Wilson, Wilson, you can't hide. We charge you with genocide. One person came up and then poured a bucket of water over his head. Some stories have it that it's urine. It was urine. And Wilson was never able to speak. Stephen Jay Gould was running the whole thing, and he sort of, you know, yelled at the demonstrators and took the side of Wilson, and Gould's going to be a main participant in this story. But the meeting was over. It was shattered. And so, you know, it's a different world. You don't see a lot of scientists getting thrown urine on and things like this, and demonstration at AAAS meetings and stuff like this, right?
But maybe it's a coming thing.
Maybe. But that was 78, right? It was a different time, I think. So the question for me then is, what was all the fuss? Why was this such a big deal? And where are we now? So that's sort of the talk. To get there, there's going to be a couple big quotes, but you have to, I think, lead into the question of reductionism. So reductionism is, I think, the most powerful methodological tool in science. And what I would describe, there's a couple different ways to view it. One is that the little parts, by studying them, you can understand the whole. But it's also reducing sciences to general laws, usually to the tiny parts, atoms or genes or electrons, etc. But there's a hierarchy. So the scientific revolution started in the physical sciences, and then the idea is to try to transform everything to look like physics. The more sciences can look like physics, like Newtonian mechanics, the more progress is made. And that will reach out eventually to ethics and philosophy, which will be reduced to biology, which will be reduced to chemistry, which is reduced to physics. You see it early on, you know, in the late 18th century, from people like Condorcet, who's, you know, the moral sciences, so things like ethics and history and philosophy, will eventually be, through progress, look a lot like the physical sciences in the way you study them. And then you get this same sort of view of reducing fields down to the ultimate sort of ending in E.O. Wilson's sociobiology. These make the exact same point because they're both highly reductionist, is how I would talk about it. Now, of course, this is where Darwin comes into it. Darwin's important because he reduced the natural sciences, the biological sciences, what they would become, into a general law. It's why he ends the greatest text in the history of biology with planets cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity. It's very important to him that people understand that this is a Newtonian framework and that he has found the law in biology that Newton found in mechanics. Now, people are smart, and they looked at this, and this is one of my favorite quotes. It's Marx to Engels, 3 years after the origin. He says, man, isn't it funny that what you get in Darwin is this struggle for existence, this the competition, capitalist society. What you see in Darwin is just a reflection of society. There was an immediate backlash against the fact that Darwin couldn't prove anything in the origin. In fact, William Hopkins is one of my favorite people that reviewed The Origin, and he says, look, okay, if you want, he knew exactly what Darwin was doing. If you want to act like the biological sciences or like the physical sciences, then I'll give it to you. But he who appeals to Caesar must be judged by Caesar's laws. If you're going to do that, I'm going to judge you like I would judge physics. And there's no predictability, there's no mathematics, it's not falsifiable. I mean, he just went through the list. The real damning critique of Darwin. The ones that supported Darwin, largely, were people like Hermann Helmholtz, a physicist, or John Tyndall, a physicist, because they loved the idea that the biological sciences should be reduced to physics and chemistry, and that's the idea of progress. And there's a long line of that as well. So this is Feynman, not sort of a friendly, wonderful man, more of an irascible character. One of the most promising hypotheses in all of biology is that everything animals do or that living creatures do can be understood in terms of what atoms can do. That is, in terms of physical laws. And so far, that's exactly what progress is. That's sort of Feynman's take on this. So right after the origin, there's this fight over laws and how the biological world should be discussed. Hopkins was right. Darwin couldn't prove anything. The way that he argued for his theory was by saying, look, all you older generation people that don't believe in it will die, and the younger generation will come up and not be brainwashed in sort of natural theological argument. And he said it will produce revolutions in all different types of sciences. So it was this promise. That was his argument. One of them was psychology, which will be, you know, put on a new foundation. And then the one time he ever brought up man, he says, look, and we'll also understand the history of man better. All of these sort of things have come to fruition. And his sort of thoughts on psychology took 150 years with E.O. Wilson before it became sociobiology. Not everyone bought in to this framework, even his followers. Huxley is perhaps the best example. For Huxley, a new type of evolution had grown up in culture, and we shouldn't use biology to lead to how we understand morality in a direct line. What you should use is the lessons of biology to create a new morality based on what we understand in culture. So it wasn't survival of the fittest, but fitting the most to survive. So right away, you also get this move to, there might be two different kinds of evolution. One is a slow genetic, let's call it Darwinian. The other is a relatively fast and cultural. They would have linked it to Lamarck or Lamarckian evolutionary theory. There was also, and you saw it in the Marx to Engels, there's also a reaction from socialists. And perhaps, and it's a long line of that leading up to today with Butchkin and others. But perhaps the most famous is Kropotkin. Kropotkin also believed morality sort of had a biological basis. It just wasn't in a Malthusian struggle. Malthus made no sense. He came up with this theory sort of in the wastelands of Siberia. And Malthus doesn't make much sense in the wastelands of Siberia. There's not a lot of people and there's not a lot of competition. What you see is species thriving when they mutually support each other, when they work together, like, you know, bees and flowers would work together. He also pinpointed the problem with a Malthusian, what he called each against all framework, in that it justified certain inequalities in society. There were social, political, economic ramifications for such a theory that's based on a sort of capitalistic, competitive theory. So instead of sort of Darwin's view, right, of a bush and these sorts of things, social Darwinism, as it became known, which is really sort of social Lamarckism, was often viewed in this sort of progressive way. This was actually the frontispiece to the Penguin edition in like 1963, 1964, and they had to get rid of it. Because you'll notice, and these things always go from like black to white, and there's a racial sort of aspect to these sorts of diagrams, and that's an aspect of that you get out of justifying hierarchies and competitive society. And this is all in Kropotkin, right? And Kropotkin's followers as well. So sociobiology existed a long time before E.O. Wilson came around. E.O. Wilson really popularized it, synthesized it. And the scientific and the social and the intellectual backdrop to E.O. Wilson's publication in 75 is an important aspect to it. The biology was going through what's termed the modern synthesis, made famous by Huxley's book, but other books published around the same time argued the same point, that Darwin didn't have genetics, now we do. If we pull together a natural selection theory and genetics, we have a modern synthesis that's going to run biology for the and make it a complete science, which is exactly what happened. So So Wilson is growing up, going to college, thinking about his career within this modern synthesis, and he loves the modern synthesis. The book he hated was Dobzhansky's, and it's a famous book on the modern synthesis called Genetics in Relation to Evolution. I think something like that, 1937. And what Dobzhansky's point was is, it's exactly right. We need genetics and we need Darwinian evolutionary theory. And when you put them together, you get the modern synthesis. But culture is not part of that. Culture is run by a different sort of framework. And so Wilson always viewed his role as bringing culture back in to within the modern synthesis. So he first does it studying ants and insects in 1971. He publishes in the Insect Societies, and includes, Wilson does this too. What he does is he publishes a book and adds a speculative last chapter. And then that speculative last chapter will become his next book that will have a speculative last chapter, which will then become his next book, etc. It's actually wonderful because you can trace, as a historian, you can trace how his ideas are being formulated. Insect societies have this speculative last chapter that says, look, sociobiology is not confined to ants and bees and other things. It also works for the larger animal kingdom, is kind of what he said. And that became the book, Sociobiology. Notice the subtitle is The New Synthesis. It's working off of Huxley's and the modern synthesis as it was known. So there, he includes a last chapter, a speculative chapter called Man, and he extends the sociobiological framework that the backdrop of all our social actions are biological to the study of humans. The first, 25 chapters formed the basis of a very mature, profitable field of sociobiology. The last chapter is speculative and highly insulting, depending on sort of your framework. It's, for instance, he jumps from things he knows a lot about, like the genera of ants, to things like past slave society in Jamaica, which it turns out he knows absolutely nothing about. The metaphors he used were extremely stark, that there was going to be combat within the fields, that the social sciences needed to be cannibalized by the biological sciences, that he called for, and I'll have this in the last slide, but it was time for ethics to be taken away from philosophers and placed in and biologicized, is what he said. And then he called for, let's say, a 20-year moratorium, he said, on hiring anyone doing ethics in philosophy departments, and let's hire them in the biology departments. So this is sort of the backdrop to his own ideas in it. There is a backdrop happening at Harvard as well. So what's happening is he and Jim Watson come in the same year in Harvard. And he hates Jim. He calls him sort of, what he says is he's going to lead to a reinvigoration of a new faith in the reductionist method. That's a quote from E.O. Wilson's autobiography, The Naturalist. He says, Watson was the fast young gun who rode into town and the one everyone wanted to emulate. And it was a position, you can even tell us in his autobiography, that Wilson coveted. In his autobiography, he explains, he places himself as the anti-reductionist, as the holistic thinker who's trying to get back to a Darwinian sort of naturalist framework. That's why it's called the naturalist. And people like Watson are the antagonists. Quote, the most unpleasant human being I'd ever met. As things deteriorated, Robert's Rules of Order had to be used in departmental meetings. No one talked to each other. And the stage was set for organismic and evolutionary biology to split from molecular and cellular biology. This is a time, Montana State went through it, a lot of universities did, when biology departments were starting to fracture. And instead of having biology, you had immunology, infectious diseases away from sometimes different part of college campuses. Wilson wanted out. He wanted out of the department, not only the department, but the entire building, so as, quote, never to have to pass another molecular biologist in the corridor. So out of the flame, into the fire. He was housed now in the same building as what are going to be his worst enemies, Richard Lewontin and Stephen Jay Gould.
Oh boy.
So it's within this intellectual framework and framework within Harvard that he comes out with sociobiology, the new synthesis. Now, it's not where people were. We're way too close to sort of the eugenics movement, World War II, all of these bad things that were linked to Darwinian evolutionary theory. And so most people, like Dawkins, for instance, is coming up with the meme instead of the gene to explain culture. Ernst Mayr had used sort of proximate and ultimate forces, these sorts of things. And so there was a distinction. People were bringing back Lamarck again to describe cultural evolution versus biological. And Wilson hated this. He wanted to unify, like Condorcet 200 years earlier, he wanted to unify all the sciences under one general unifying law, and that was evolution through natural selection. So that's what this last chapter is about. This last chapter, then, is expanded into an entire book on human nature, published 3 years later, the year that he was, got urine thrown on his head, and it expands an entire book on what, you know, how this works, and it goes through aggression, sex, altruism, and religion. Now, the funny thing is if you've read The Descent of Man of Darwin, all this stuff's been covered. Darwin had chapters on religion, on the creation of morals, on God. All of it has to do with our biological basis and that these things are good through selection theory for the propagation of the race. So Wilson is bringing all this back, but in sort of modern guard. Criminality, for instance, it's linked to innate aggression. Property ownership. Perhaps property ownership is learned, but it's prepared by territorialism and the territorialist gene, right? Military action may be cultural, but modern war was, and I'll quote, a straightforward example of a hypertrophied biological predisposition, right? So private property, religion, modern warfare, all of these things can be found in the gene. The last chapter, then, is a chapter on ethics. What he's trying to do is create, quote, a democratically contrived eugenics, or in another quote, a genetically accurate and hence completely fair code of ethics. It's exactly what the followers of Darwin, Huxley, and others were trying to do in defending Darwin. They were all agnostics, and they were trying to come up with a new code of ethics based on evolutionary theory rather than sort of monotheism, right? So the backlash then within all of this comes from the scientists themselves, and it's a direct lineage from Kropotkin, Marx, and others. A New York Times Review of Books published a scathing critique of sociobiology. It was signed by like 35 people, but we know now that it was written by Dick Lewontin. Richard Lewontin was the main author. It pointed to how similar the theories were as the theories of IQ, leading to racial hierarchies, to the eugenics movement, and the justification of privileging certain groups over others according to class, race, and sex. Wilson responded in the same place, New York Review of Books, that was an openly partisan attack, self-righteous vigilantism, and an attack on free inquiry and discussion crucial to the health of the intellectual community. So he went kind of to freedom of speech. He blamed what he called the Marxists and New Left scholars. Lewontin and Gould were both socialist, if not communist, and it was their fault. So he focused the debate on sort of political terms. He later admitted he didn't know anything about Marxism, and in E.O. Wilson fashion, so he went and read everything there was to read about Marx, including Marx himself, digging into that material. Gould comes in, and so Gould is, you know, he was a great science writer and also a great scientist, as is Richard Lewontin. But he also knew his history really well, so he could have given this talk up here about the links backwards. For Gould, it wasn't that science could be used nefariously and always was. It was bad science. There was no evidence to back it up. It made incorrect assumptions. It talked about sort of human nature, but used sort of capitalist, competitive, Darwinian sort of terminology and framework as these sort of baseless assumptions. So it was clouded by ideology, right? Gould and Lewontin were arguing against an overly genetic-based, genetic-centric based view of evolution. They wanted to look at evolution as a process of development that was working in tune with larger environmental effects. The first wave of attack for Wilson was from geneticists, molecular biologists, paleontologists, and others. As the Human Genome Project took off in the 1980s and gene centrism became more and more popular, and you had all these scientists, but also sort of popular presentations of the scientists talking about the gay gene, an alcoholic gene, and even a gene for hierarchy, none of which were ever found. Of course, that's not how it ended up working. They didn't know that at the time. Others were still trying to separate between sort of cultural evolution, which follows sort of a Lamarckian framework, and biological evolution, which follows a genetic Darwinian framework. The humanists jumped on the bandwagon of Lewontin and Gould. So when I was in graduate school, I wasn't reading E.O. Wilson except to make fun of him. I was reading Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin and, you know, practicing my good leftist anti-sort of science routine. It was bad for the humanities. It was a reaction to this gene-centric process, and it led, in part, turn the humanities, especially history of science, into a constructivist, sort of leftist mentality. What we would call the cultural turn in the history of science, or the social constructivist turn, I guess is what we would call it. So Victor Frankenstein creates this monster, doesn't even name it because he doesn't even take responsibility for his actions, and then this monster goes and kills everyone in the book, right? In a subtitle of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is The Modern Prometheus, and Wilson comes out with another book called Promethean Fire. Where he backs off a little bit. He says culture does matter. It's just culture is genetic. and it is on a leash. So it limits the adaptability of cultures by your gene, and this is where this on the leash phrase comes from. This was the reaction in the humanities. It lasted from sort of 70s onward. And what I want to talk about then now is where we are. Is that still where we are? Humanists like me who look at science studies and study science are very interested in sort of the relationship between social and cultural forces and the type of science that you get out of that. And then they're interested in the type of science you get out of it, how does it then justify, enhance, enrich the status quo, the rich and the powerful. That's the sort of way I was trained. I belong to a really cool department with really interesting historians, Brett Walker and Tim LaCane and others who I came in with. They're sort of my generation here, came in here right around 2000, all of us together. And they were much more mindful to stick closely, not to a social constructivist worldview, but they're environmental historians, and it's very different because environmental historians use science, particularly ecology, to understand humans' relationships to the natural world. It's very unhistorical in my framework because you've got to understand why ecology is ecology, deconstruct it before you would use it. And Brett and Tim are like, whatever, dude. You know, ecology matters, and we need to study it and figure out where we are. So since that time period and what we're doing here, and I would argue all of major historians of science and environmental historians are now part of what I would call a biological turn. In fact, there was a special issue, the American Historical Review, which is our main history publication, in 2012, based out of a conference in 2010 called History Meets Biology. So I want to go through some of that work. Some of my favorite is work by Daniel Lord Schmail on a book he's got plenty called on Deep History in the Brain. So Deep, he views himself as doing this deep history, which insists on breaking down any stark distinctions between human history and evolutionary history, requiring inclusion of what we call prehistory. He calls his work neurohistory, which is a fusion of neuroscience and deep history of our brain, quote, a new kind of interdisciplinarity that joins the humanities and social sciences with the physical and life sciences. Smale faults these earlier work for making distinctions between cultural evolution and biological evolution. That's not how it works. They're all guided by the larger process of selection theory. Ideas compete within a Darwinian framework, passed down to the next generation based on their success or failure within specific cultures. As with natural selection, the process is blind, just based on blind variation and selective retention. There's no ultimate design in it. Behavior is passed down through the cultural processes and directly affect our neurology. This is why culture is so adaptive and why we need to study its interaction with genetics on multiple levels. The microscale, individual decisions matter, directing and guiding the transmission of certain learned traits. On the macro level, cultural practices, working through neurophysiology of our bodies and interacting in different cultures in different ways, then determines our genetic makeup. Environmental influences, then, whether you live next to a highway or not, matter, and it, where we live or what our mothers ate or drank or what we experienced in early childhood in our formative years, these can be expressed genetically and then passed on. Cultural causes specific transformations in human physiology, including changes at the genetic level, which direct different cultures in different ways. Another avenue of research is popularized by Edmund Russell, but there's plenty of people working on it, called evolutionary history. we often view history in anthropocentric terms. Humans are the main subject. So one of his main accomplishments in his work is taking us out of the center position. He focuses on co-evolution. So cultural developments, like our preference for protein or domesticating cows, have shaped the genetic makeup of cattle, which in turn directly shaped the genetic makeup of humans by facilitating certain traits. Fitness of humans, for instance, to the ability to digest milk. These same domesticated cows also affect human sociocultural evolution, pulling us into certain types of economic relationships and transforming our practices from where we live and what we ingest to interactions between governments to the role of nation states. And it's also increasingly changing our natural environment. As we eat milk and produce meat, it's now one of the leading causes of climate change. Thus, domesticated animals have shaped the direction of society and culture, in a sense domesticating humans and directing their actions. So just as we have shaped wheat and cotton and cows, so wheat, cotton, and cows have shaped us. As Russell would argue, it is actually very difficult in these instances to determine who is initiating the process, who is domesticating whom, basically. As humans increase the production of certain types of cows or corn, the process all selected for certain types of genes in humans who could digest those plants and animals. They're very successful animals. Wheat is very successful, as is marijuana. As is milk, etc. All right. My own colleague here has just recently published a book last year. It's a really incredible book, I think, that talks a lot about these topics. And he's put all this work together in what he terms neo-materialism. In the emerging near-materialist view, quoting Laclain, the environment is understood to shape human biology and culture not just through the slow process of Darwinian selection on genes, though this obviously still plays an important role, but through the real-time effects of food, toxins, buildings, machines, and other material things acting on bodies and brains of individuals and groups of humans at every stage of their lives and the lives of our species, right? So who we are, what we create, it's a product of biology and culture interacting in sort of creative and very surprising ways. So I'll bring this together and end with E.O. Wilson's recent publication. He's probably published two books since then, but it was published in 2016, The Origin of Creativity. It's a horrible, horrible book, almost unreadable. As one of my students said, these are his personal notes that he should have left on his shelf. And I thought, man, that's a pretty good description of what's going on here.
So that book didn't win the Pulitzer, right?
No, it did not. But he's flopped. He's flipped. He's learned a lot from this biological turn in the humanities, the role of culture. He's no longer talking about, this sort of scientists humans should consider together, that time has come for ethics to be removed from the hands of philosophers and biologized. That's what you get. That should be 75. In 2016, it would seem appropriate to return philosophy to its once esteemed position, this time at the center of humanistic science, etc. So why has he done that? It's partly because Schmale and other peoples are also at Harvard, and as he did with Marx, he's dived in and started reading some of this material. But it's also because he's moved sort of to an environmental framework, and he understands, I think, the role that for this to really succeed, for us to save the planet, we have to bring together the humanities and the social sciences with the sciences instead of cannibalizing them, as he would write about in sociobiology. He starts with the shortcomings of history. He points to the need for humanists, historians specifically, to fully incorporate the notion of prehistory into their work. Until a better picture can be drawn of prehistory, quoting him, and by that means the evolutionary steps that led to present-day human nature, The humanities will remain rootless. As a product of culture, the job of the historian should be to connect, quote, the deep history of genetic evolution to the history of cultural evolution. Another shortcoming is what he calls the extreme anthropocentrism, where humans are separated from the organic world and only stories of humans and not animals and plants are being told. It calls for a focus on other flora and fauna, from the microbial to the charismatic, from amoebas to timber wolves. His text is a further move to what he has termed gene culture coevolution, in which cultural innovations increase the rate at which genes favoring intelligence and cooperation, etc., were spread more rapidly, and acting in reciprocity, the resulting genetic chain increases the likelihood of cultural innovation. For Wilson, it's just this idea of gene-cultural coevolution that is so fundamental to the unity of science and the humanity. And this is when, in the book, he calls for this return of philosophy to its central position. Of course, all these shortcomings he's talking about are the exact approaches being taken right now in history, represented by neurohistory, deep history, evolutionary history, and neo-materialism. It's seen that in the work of Schmale and Russell and Tim LaCaine and others who are pulling prehistory into history, that are moving away from anthropocentrism, that are taking into account the cultural and the material as working together. Now, there's reasons I like this move, right? Because of my training and because of my hatred for E.O. Wilson in the 1990s, I'm well prepared to fight any move to fight this idea that culture is held on a leash by genetics. But I also realize that there's a biological basis for human social behavior. So what this new work then represents is a bringing together, evening out of empowerment for culture, cultural studies, and biological studies, bringing to fruition what Gould predicted right before his death of, quote, a mutual illumination between two vigorous independent disciplines, Darwinian theory and cultural history. I would call that maybe the new modern synthesis. Right. Two things are a good example of this, and this is when I'll end with, and I kind of get out of my area of expertise, but one of them is niche construction. So the idea, which dates back, like sociobiology, to Darwin and his last work, The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms, 1881. He showed how worms modified their soil environment, helping other animals and plants to survive, and then therefore directing their own evolutionary pathway or niche in the process. Conrad Waddington advanced these ideas in the mid-20th century, but it was actually brought to prominence by Richard Lewontin, partly in response to Wilson's gene-centered approach. Humans are transforming their environment through cultural practices like agriculture and animal and plant husbandry and capitalism and creation of nation states, which are then in part of the process of selecting for traits at the genetic level, helping to direct human evolution. New research in epigenetics is doing the same, furthering the same idea along with niche construction that many scientists are calling an extended evolutionary synthesis. Playing again on this new synthesis, now extended synthesis. The idea that changes in the environment can lead to changes in an organism, which can then be transferred biologically to offspring, that even predates Lamarck. But again, it received its name by Waddington as part of his research on niche construction. He examined how extra or epigenetic forces could be heritable. Work that has expanded in the last two decades into detailed analyses of how environmental transformations can change our genome. Many would call this Lamarckian. Many of these environmental transformations are caused by cultural shifts, such as transformed economic relations, which can produce bodily epigenetic responses, which then regulate gene expression. And you can see a lot of this work in people like Schmale, Deep History of the Brain, and Russell's Evolutionary History, and LaCaine's Neo-Materialism. why is this stuff important? I think cultural, so think back to the last chapter of Communicating Science with Alan Gross, what our last chapter of this book will look like will be again trying to equate or use both cultural niche construction leading to epigenetic changes. Actually seems like the perfect analytical tool in which study not only biological change but also intellectual change, how ideas from the minds of scientists like E.O. Wilson get produced, adapted, or transformed. In the end, it can help us understand how science and culture work and how changes in both come about. So perhaps it's time for us to drop the metaphor, to stop thinking of changing ideas as acting like biological change. Perhaps we need to drop that. Wilson, of course, has been pushing this idea for some time. Quote, "The evolution of the arts parallels organic evolution in the manner they both work. Originality and style are everything, measured by the degree to which the innovations attract imitation," end quote. The imitation and innovation is taking place in both realms, in the sciences, biological sciences, and in the humanities, certainly in cultural history, a process that mimics how evolution of social behavior works. It's not as if they are the same. I would argue they are exactly the same. So I'll end there.